Chained and heavily guarded, Kadim al-Jurf was allowed on deck for a few hours each day. Tom and Dorian took turns to interrogate him. With the dried pigskin casting its shadow across the deck, Kadim responded to their questions, if not willingly, at least with some show of respect. However, that disconcerting stare never faded from his eyes. Though Tom and Dorian phrased the same questions in different guises, Kadim's replies were consistent, and he avoided the traps they set for him. He must have known what his eventual fate would be. The law allowed Dorian and Mansair little discretion of mercy. When they stared at him, Kadim saw death in their eyes, and all he could hope for was that when the time came, they would grant him a swift, dignified execution without the horror of dismemberment or the sacrilege of the pigskin. Over the weeks, Kadim's incarceration in the Orlop developed its own routine and rhythm. Three Arab seamen shared the duty of acting as his warders during the night, each taking a shift of 4 hours. They'd been carefully chosen by Batula, and at first they were mindful of his orders. While themselves remaining mute, they reported Kadim's most casual remarks to Batula. However, the nights were long, and the guard duty as dull as the need to remain awake was onerous. Kadim had been trained by the most famous mullahs of the Royal House of Oman in dialectic and religious debate. The things he whispered in the darkness to his warders, while the rest of the crew were ashore or sleeping on the upper deck, were compelling to those devout young men. The truths he spoke were too poignant and moving to report to Batula. They could not close their ears to him, and they listened at first with awe when he spoke of the truth and beauty of God's way. Then they began against their own will to respond to his whispers with their own. From the fire in his eyes they knew Kadim to be a holy man. By the fervour of his own devotion and the unassailable logic of his words, they were convinced. Slowly they were held in thrall by Kadim ibn Abu Bakr. Meanwhile, the excitement of impending departure built up in the rest of the company. The last sticks of furniture and goods were taken from the huts at the forest edge and ferried on board. On Good Friday, Tom and Mansur applied torches to the empty huts. The thatch had dried out and they burned like bonfires. The day after Good Friday, they sailed early in the morning watch, so that Tom had light enough to make out the channel. The wind stood fair offshore, and he led the little flotilla out through the heads into the open sea. It was midday, and the land was low and blue on the western horizon, before one of the crew came up from below decks in a state of terrible agitation. Tom and Dorian were on the quarter-deck together, Dorian seated in the sling chair Tom had rigged for him. At first, neither could understand the man's wild shouts. "Kadim!" Tom caught the gist of it. He went bounding down the companionway to the orlop deck. Locked securely in the wooden cage that the carpenters had built for him, Kadim was curled in sleep upon the straw mattress. His chains were still secured to the ring bolts in the deck. Tom seized a corner of the single blanket that covered the prisoner from the top of his head to his feet, jerked it aside, and then kicked the dummy that lay beneath it. It was cunningly made of two sacks filled with oakum and tied with short pieces of old rope to give it the outline of a human body beneath the blanket. They searched the ship swiftly from stem to stern, Tom and Dorian with swords in hand, raging through the holds and probing every corner and cranny. "Three other men are missing," Batula reported with a shamed face. "Who are they?" Dorian demanded. Batula hesitated before he could bring himself to answer. "Rashud, Pina and Haban," he croaked. "The same three men I set to guard him." Tom altered course and steered alongside the Revenge. Through the speaking tube he hailed Mansur, who had command of her. Both vessels went about and headed back towards the entrance of the lagoon, but the winds that had allowed them to clear the lagoon so handily now blocked them offshore. For days more they beat back and forth across the entrance. Twice they were almost piled up to the reef as Tom, in frustration, tried to force the passage. It was 6 days after they had sailed that at last they dropped anchor off the beach of the lagoon once again. Since their departure it had rained heavily, and when they went ashore they found that any sign left by the fugitives had been washed away. "Yet there is only one direction they would have taken," Tom pointed up the valley. But they have almost 9 days' start on us. If we are to catch up with them, we must march at once." He ordered Batula and Kumra to check the weapons lockers and the magazines. They came ashore with sorry expressions to report that 4 muskets were missing, with the same number of cutlasses, bullet bags, and powder flasks. Tom stopped himself reviling the 2 captains further, for they had already suffered enough. Dorian argued vehemently when Tom told him he must stay behind to take care of the ships and Sarah while they chased the fugitives. In the end, Sarah joined in to convince him that he was not yet strong enough for such an expedition, which would call for hard marches and perhaps even harder fighting. Tom selected 10 of his best men to go with him, those who were proficient with sword, musket, and pistol. An hour after they'd first stepped ashore, all were ready. Tom kissed Sarah, and they left the beach heading inland. Tom and Mansair strode out at the head of the line of armed men. "I would that little Buckut were with us," Tom muttered. "He would follow them, though they grew wings and flew 10 feet above the ground." "You are a most famous elephant hunter, Uncle Tom. I have heard you tell it since I was a child." "That was more than 1 or 2 ago," Tom smiled ruefully, "and you must not remember all I tell you. Boasts and brags are like debts and childhood sweethearts. They often come back to plague the man who made them." At noon on the 3rd day they stood on the crest of the range of mountains that ran in an unbroken rampart north and south. The slopes below them were covered with banks of purple heather. This was the dividing line between the littoral and the inland plateau of the continental shield. Behind, the forests lay like a green carpet down to the edge of the ocean. Ahead, the hills were harsh and rocky, and the plains were endless, stretching for ever to the horizon, blue with distance. The tiny dust clouds kicked up by the moving herds of game drifted in the warm breezes. "Any one of those might mark the path of the men we are hunting. But the hooves of the herds would have wiped out their tracks," Tom told Mansur. "Still in all, I doubt that they would have headed into that great emptiness. Cadam would have the sense at least to try to find human habitation." "The Cape Colony?" Mansur looked southwards. "More likely the Arab forts along the Fever Coast or the Portuguese territory of Mozambique." "The land is so big," Mansur scowled. "They could have gone anywhere." "We will wait for the scouts to come in before we decide what next to do." Tom had sent his best men to cast north and south, ordering them to try to cut Cadam's trail. He would not say so to Mansur, not yet at least, but he knew that their chances were remote. Cadam had too long a start on them, and as Mansur had remarked, the land was big. The rendezvous Tom had set, at which to meet the scouts, was a distinctive peak shaped like a cocked hat that could be seen from 20 leagues in any direction. They camped on the southern slope of the edge of the tree line, and the scouts came dribbling back during the night. None had been able to cut human sign. "They've got clean away, lad," Tom told his nephew. "I think we can do naught else but let them go and turn back for the ships. But I would like your agreement. It is your duty to your mother that dictates what we do next." "Cadam was only the messenger," Mansur said. "My blood feud is with his master in Lamu, Zayn al-Din." "I agree, Uncle Tom. This is fruitless. Our energies may best be expended elsewhere." "Think on this also, lad. Cadam will fly straight back to his master, the pigeon to its loft. When we find Zayn, Cadam will be at his side if the lions have not eaten him first." Mansur's face brightened and his shoulders straightened. "In God's name, Uncle, I had not considered that. Of course, you're right. As for Cadam perishing in the wilderness, it seems to me that he has the animal tenacity and fanatical faith to survive. I feel sure we'll meet him again. He will not escape my vengeance. Let's hurry back to the ships." Before first light, Sarah left her bunk in the little cabin of the Sprite. Then, as she had done every morning since Tom left, she went ashore and climbed to the hilltop above the lagoon. From there she watched for Tom's return. From afar she recognised his tall, straight figure and his swinging walk at the head of his men. The image blurred as her eyes filled with tears of joy and relief. "Thank you, God, that you paid heed to my prayers," she cried aloud, and ran down the hillside straight into his arms. "I was so worried that you would get yourself into trouble again without me to look after you, Tom Courtney."
"I had no chance for trouble, Sarah Courtney." He hugged her hard. "More's the pity."
He looked to Mansur. "You are faster than me, lad. Run ahead to warn your father that we are returning, and to have the ships ready to sail again as soon as I set foot aboard." Mansur set off at once. As soon as he was out of earshot, Sarah said, "You're the crafty one, aren't you, Thomas? You did not want to be the one who gave the bitter news to Dorry that Yassi's murder is unrevenged."
"'Tis Mansur's duty more than mine," Tom replied breezily. "Dorry would have it no other way. The only profit in this bloody business is that it might bring father and son closer than they have ever been before. And that was mighty close."
They sailed with the ebb of the tide. The wind stood fair, and they had made good their offing before darkness fell. The ships were within 2 cables' length of each other, with the wind fresh on the quarter, their best point of sailing. The Revenge showed her new turn of speed and began to pull ahead of the Sprite. Thus it was with reluctance that Tom gave the order to shorten sail for the night. It seemed a pity not to take full advantage of the wind that was bearing them so swiftly towards Nativity Bay.
"But I am a trader and not a man of war," Tom consoled himself.
As he gave the order to shorten sail, he saw Mansur in the Revenge furl his staysail and reef his mizzen and main. Both ships hoisted lanterns to their maintops to enable them the better to keep night stations on each other. Tom was ready to give over the quarter-deck to Cumrah and go down to the small saloon for the supper that he could smell Sarah was cooking. He recognised the rich aroma of one of her famous spiced babooties, and saliva flooded into his mouth. He spent a few more minutes checking the set of the sails and the pointing of the helmsman. Satisfied at last, he turned towards the head of the companionway, then stopped abruptly. He stared at the dark eastern horizon and muttered, mystified, "There is a great fire out there. Is it a ship ablaze? No, it's something greater than that. The fires of a volcano?" The crew on deck had seen it too and crowded to the rail, gawking and gabbling. Then, to Tom's utter astonishment, there burst over the dark horizon a monstrous ball of celestial fire. It lit the dark surface of the sea. Across the water the sails of the Revenge glowed palely in this ghostly emanation.
"A comet, by God!"
Tom shouted in wonder, and stamped on the deck above the saloon.
"Sarah Courtney, come up here at once. You have never seen aught such as this, nor will you ever again."
Sarah came flying up the ladder with Dorian close behind her. They stopped and stared in wonder, struck speechless by the splendour of the sight. Then Sarah came to Tom and placed herself within the protective circle of his arms.
"It is a sign," she whispered. "It's a benediction from on high for the old life we have left behind at Good Hope, and a promise of the new life that lays ahead of us."
Dorian left them, moved slowly down the deck until he reached the bows and sank to his knees. He turned his face up to the sky.
"All the days of mourning have passed," he said. "Your time here on earth with me is over. Go, Yasmini, my little darling. I commit you to the arms of God, but you must know that my heart and all my love go with you."
Across the dark water, Mansur Courtney saw the comet, and he ran to the main shrouds and leapt into them. He clambered swiftly upwards until he reached the maintop. He threw an arm around the top gallant mast, balancing lithely against the roll and pitch of the hull, which were magnified by the 60 feet that separated him from the surface of the sea. He lifted his face to the sky, and his long, thick hair streamed back in the wind.
"The death of kings!" he cried. "The destruction of tyrants! All these portentous events heralded by God's finger writing in the heavens!"
Then he filled his lungs and shouted into the wind,
"Hear me, Zayn al-Din, I am Nemesis, and I am coming for you."
Night after night, as the two little ships sailed northwards, the comet climbed overhead, seeming to light their way, until at last they picked out a tall bluff of land that rose out of the dark waters ahead of their bows like the back of a monstrous whale.
At the northern end of the promontory, the whale's mouth opened. They sailed through this entrance into a huge landlocked bay, far greater in extent than the lagoon of the elephants. On one side the land was steep too. On the other it stretched in dense mangrove swamps, but between them lay the lovely embouchure of a river of sweet, clear water, flanked by gently sloping beaches that offered a natural landing place. "This is not our first visit to this place. Dorian and I have been here many times before. The natives hereabouts call this river Ombilo," Tom told Sarah, as he steered for the beach and dropped his anchor in 3 fathoms. Looking over the side, they could watch the steel flukes burying themselves in the pale sandy bottom, and the brilliant shoals of fish swirling as they feasted on the small crabs and shrimps disturbed from their burrows by the anchor. When all the canvas was furled, the yards sent down, and both ships at rest, Tom and Sarah stood by the rail and watched Mansur row ashore from the Revenge, eager to explore these new surroundings. "The restlessness of youth," Tom said. "If restlessness is the sign of tender age, then you are an infant in arms, Master Tom," she replied. "That is most unfair to me," he chuckled, "but I shall let it pass." She shaded her eyes and studied the shoreline. "Where is the Maelstone?"
"There, at the foot of the bluff. But do not set your hopes too high."
"Of course not," she snapped at him.
But she thought, "He need not try to protect me from disappointment. I know with a mother's sure instinct that Jim is close. Even if he has not yet reached this spot, he soon will. I need only be patient, and my son will come back to me."
Tom offered an olive branch by changing the subject in a placatory tone. "What do you think of the spot upon the globe, Sarah Courtney?"
"I like it well enough. Perhaps I will grow to like it even more if you allow me to rest here more than a day and a night." She accepted his peace offering with a smile.
"Then Dorian and I will begin to mark out the site for our new fort and trading post immediately."
Tom lifted his glass to his eye. He and Dorian had done most of this work on their last visit to Nativity Bay. He ran the glass over the site they had chosen then. It was on a promontory in a meander of the river. Because the Ombilo waters enclosed 3 sides, it was easy to defend. A constant supply of fresh water was also assured, and there was a good field of fire in all directions. In addition, it was under the guns of the anchored ships, and would benefit from their support in the event of an attack by savage tribesmen or other enemies.
"Yes," he nodded with satisfaction, "it'll suit our purpose well enough. We will start work tomorrow at the latest, and you shall design our private quarters for me just as you did at Fort Providence 20 years ago.
"That was our honeymoon," she said, with awakening enthusiasm.
"Aye, lass," Tom smiled down at her, "and this shall be our second of that ilk."